From WBUR Boston, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. All over the headlines, a battle between two heavyweight Republicans, Chris Christie and Rand Paul. Jabs over federal surveillance and spending. Warnings of what Christie called a strain of libertarianism in his party, a strain that's very much a part of Rand Paul's political philosophy and behind his big critiques on the NSA, on spending, and more. This hour on Point, Rand Paul and others on libertarianism and the future of the Republican Party. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation never ends. We've seen it before. What do you make of libertarianism now? Is it the way for a new GOP? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Late this hour, we'll hear from a big libertarian voice in the Republican Party, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. But first, from Washington with a political perspective, Molly Ball is with us. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic. She covers national politics and has been thinking a lot about the future of the GOP, its rebranding, and the libertarian surge. Molly Ball, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, John. Great to be here.
Molly, let me start by asking you to set the stage. We're now 8 months past or 9 months past a national election in which Republicans lost badly. They set about to diagnose what was wrong with their party, do a reset of sorts. What's the status of that reset, and what is the role that libertarians might play in it?
I think what we have going on is a hot war. If there was a cold war before between the factions in the Republican Party, it has now sort of escalated. And you do have various different strains, both on the intellectual level, the sort of pundits and thinkers and think tank people sort of arguing their case for the brand of Republicanism that they think is the future. And also very much at the grassroots level, you see this playing out with individual congressmen and senators confronting their constituents and at town hall and with the Tea Party and so on. So I think this is very much a work in progress. Now, libertarianism, I think, has emerged largely thanks to the prominence of Senator Paul as one of the biggest competitors for this sort of dubious trophy of the future philosophy of the Republican Party. And what Senator Paul is saying is, on the one hand, that this is a philosophy that is saleable to a lot of non-traditional Republican constituencies, particularly young voters. But he's also tried to do a lot of outreach to minorities. He's spoken at historically black universities and also to many Hispanic audiences and was an active participant in the immigration reform debate, even though he didn't end up voting for the Senate bill for his own reasons. And then he's making the pitch that this is a philosophy that's sort of suited to the times. He's also saying that he's not his father, that his father, who at one point was a member of the Libertarian Party and left the Republican Party, Rand Paul is much more of a team player. He has done a lot of things in concert with the RNC and with the chairman, Reince Priebus. He's explicitly making a pitch to reform the Republican Party from the inside, and he has tacked a little bit more toward the mainstream from some of his father's stances on everything from military engagement to the gold standard, trying to make himself a more mainstream politician.
He's aligned himself with Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate.
He has, on a personal level, not necessarily philosophically. You do see, you know, McConnell joined Rand Paul on the floor when Senator Paul did his famous filibuster, and that was a pretty remarkable show of support from this man who sort of typifies the Republican establishment for this very insurgent voice of Rand Paul. But I think on actual issues, particularly of national security, you do see quite a bit of daylight between the two men, but they have a very good working relationship. You know, Rand Paul campaigned against Mitch McConnell in his primary in Kentucky, where he beat the handpicked candidate of Mitch McConnell in that Republican primary in Kentucky. And then very immediately, both men set about rebuilding those bridges. There's something in it for both of them. McConnell needs credibility with the right in order to win a primary next year in Kentucky. Paul, on the other hand, needs that sort of entree into the establishment to convince the sort of Republican institutional players that he's legitimate and not, as John McCain so memorably called him, a wacko bird.
Right. Well, you mentioned John McCain. We've heard recently the back and forth between Chris Christie and Rand Paul, a lot of speculation those two will run for president in 2016. Aside from those two men, who would you describe as the principal combatants of this hot war, and who else besides Rand Paul is speaking for the libertarian point of view?
Speaking for the libertarian point of view, you actually have several members of the Congress now, mostly in the House, who are directly inspired by Ron Paul and his philosophy. There's a congressman in Kentucky, Congressman Massey. There's a congressman out of Michigan, Justin Amash, who put that amendment to limit NSA surveillance, got that on the floor of the House recently and had a pretty shockingly close vote on that. So there are actually now, you know, Ron Paul was always sort of a lonely voice, but there you see the success of the Ron Paul movement in the way a lot more actual sitting elected officials stand for these ideals.
And where does Ted Cruz of Texas fit into this argument?
I don't think we can call Ted Cruz a libertarian. Ted Cruz is, you might almost call him a paleoconservative. He's much more a sort of pure right winger, if you will. He's also a very strong social conservative. But the social conservatives and the libertarians are frequently at odds. And one of the voices that was strongest against Ron Paul in the 2012 Republican primaries was Rick Santorum, the sort of epitome of the social conservative candidate. And he frequently went after Ron Paul for everything from his stance on Iran, saying Iran could be allowed to get a nuclear weapon, to his stance on gay marriage, where the libertarian perspective is that government shouldn't interfere with individual decisions. It's debatable where libertarians stand on the abortion issue. Ron and Rand Paul both are strongly pro-life. Other libertarians say that that's another individual choice that the government shouldn't interfere with. But on gay marriage, Rand Paul has said he would leave that up to the states.
Molly,
states want to allow or ban gay marriage.
I want to bring in another libertarian voice. That's David Bowes. He's the executive vice president at the Cato Institute, author of The Politics of Freedom and Libertarianism, a Primer. He's been watching this for a long time. David Bowes from Washington, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let me ask you this. I was reading an article the other day that talked about the assertion that this may be libertarianism's moment in the political debate. But on the other hand, people have been saying that for decades, that for 50 years, libertarianism has been the next new thing in political thought. Tell me why this moment is different.
Well, I think there are several reasons. And I do think libertarianism as an idea in America has been growing. I've never thought of libertarianism as a Republican idea, but if either major party wants to move in a libertarian direction, I'm all in favor of that. I think there are several reasons that it's actually moving into the political arena in a way that it hasn't before. One is the tremendous growth of government in the Bush-Obama years, particularly around the financial crisis. That tends to send people looking for alternatives. Another is the neocons have had a dozen years to practice their foreign policy, and I think people are getting tired of that, so that the idea of staying out of foreign wars is drawing more attention. Certainly, the surprising success of Ron Paul's two presidential campaigns attracted a lot more people to the Republican Party with libertarian ideas.
You and I spoke last year, and you said that there was a time when people said they were introduced to libertarianism by Ayn Rand, and in this generation, it's Ron Paul.
Yes, I think that's right. I think for a long time, Ayn Rand's novels were a particular way that people got into libertarian ideas. And since about 2007, a whole lot more people probably have come in through Ron Paul's campaigns. And I do think all the issues Ron Paul talked about in 2007 and early 2008, the Federal Reserve and sound money, Republican overspending, endless wars, people weren't ready to listen in 2007 and January of 2008. When he came back in 2011, everybody knew something had gone wrong with the Federal Reserve and its easy money. Everybody knew there was a spending problem, and a lot more people were tired of the wars. So all of that, I think, was significant. And alongside this change in the issues that people are looking at has been a substantial growth in the libertarian movement, partly because of the Paul campaigns, partly because of the growth of two national libertarian student organizations that are bringing lots more young people into the organized libertarian movement, not just young people who have generally libertarian ideas.
But David, when I talked to Ron Paul last year at the Republican convention, he said, I got lucky in a way because we had the bailouts and we had the financial crisis and huge deficits that fueled our arguments. But now that the economy is recovering, the bailouts have receded in prominence, the deficit has come down as the economy has recovered, does that take some of the steam out of the momentum that you were describing?
Well, Rand Paul and I are from Kentucky, and I think if you go to Kentucky and ask people if the economy is back, you're going to get quizzical looks. I don't think the economy is back very strong. Someday, if it actually does come back, then yes, that will take some of the steam out of it. Nevertheless, there is far more libertarian consciousness, libertarian organization than there has been before. There is still the overextension of America's military around the world that I think people will continue to be concerned about. And I certainly think people are going to, you know, we're still talking about the Great Depression. I think people are going to continue to talk about what caused the financial crisis, which I would tend to say was the Federal Reserve and overregulation from Washington, so it'll remain an issue.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about libertarians and the GOP. Later this hour, we'll hear from Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky on how he sees the movement and its role in Republican politics. But first, we're back with Molly Ball of The Atlantic and David Bowes of the Cato Institute. And David, I want to start by playing you a clip of Chris Christie and the way that he went after Rand Paul, and it raises the issue that you mentioned before about neoconservative foreign policy. Here's Chris Christie.
As a former prosecutor and who was appointed by President George W. Bush on September 10th, 2001. I just want us to be really cautious because this strain of libertarianism that's going through both parties right now and making big headlines, I think is a very dangerous thought.
David Bowes, very dangerous thought. Do you think that Chris Christie's attack resonated? And how do you think that exchange went down with the American public?
I think that exchange gave the American public more introduction to the idea of libertarianism per se, using the word, than anything I can think of. So I appreciate his doing it. I've been surprised this summer how strongly to the right Chris Christie seems to be moving. He really attacked the Supreme Court decision on gay marriage, which surprised me because he'd been more moderate on that before. And here, going after libertarianism, which is another idea of being skeptical of big government, of moving in a more socially tolerant direction. I think that's an interesting move that he's decided maybe his image for the Republican Party had been too East Coast moderate and he's going to double down on being a right winger. But if he wants
may have
to
tried
campaign,
to be undoing a bit of that Hurricane Sandy damage that he took from Republicans.
Well, that's right. That was some of the moderate image, and he's certainly trying to undo that. But if he wants to defend the Bush foreign policy and the Bush-Obama spying on everything from where our cars are to what's on our telephones, then good luck. But I think we should have that debate. And, you know, in 2008, the Democrats had a very long presidential campaign, one of the longest we've seen. And yet they never disagreed on a single idea. It was just two people saying, no, I should be president. I should be president. If the Republicans can have a presidential campaign where they actually debate ideas like liberty and the extent of individual freedom versus what kind of security programs we need, how much spying is too much spying, how much presidential authority is too much presidential authority, then I think that'll be a very healthy thing for the country. And so I appreciate Chris Christie kicking that off.
Molly Ball, you heard Rand Paul respond by calling Chris Christie, the king of bacon. How do you think that exchange went, and what conclusions did you draw about where the Republican Party is going to sort this out?
I think it's going to be fascinating, just like David says, to see this sort of battle of ideas play out in the Republican primary, because they are two very starkly different versions. There is – and we even saw this to some extent with Mitt Romney's campaign, where he had a lot of trouble articulating a sort of foreign policy vision that was, on the one hand, distinct from President Obama, but on the other hand, appealing to both the Republican base and sort of the national middle. And we had episodes like his sort of widely panned press conference after the Benghazi attacks, where he was like Chris Christie, sort of trying to articulate a sort of hawkish far right position on national security. When a lot of libertarians and liberals believe that this administration is already quite far to the right on a lot of those things, when on everything from surveillance to foreign intervention. So this is one of those main fissures within the party that I don't know what. The Republican Party wants on this score, and I think it's that referendum that Rand Paul represents
that is going
to tell us where the Republicans want to go.
I wonder, Molly, how big the fissure is, because, David talked a minute ago about how, well, if Chris Christie wants to stand for unlimited NSA data gathering, fine, and we'll have that debate. But doesn't the public reaction or lack of reaction to the NSA disclosures tell us that they have grown pretty comfortable with the idea that you need a forward-leaning security state to protect the country? Isn't that the high side of public opinion?
I think from where I sit, public opinion was very divided, and there was certainly an outpouring of reaction to those stories about the NSA. I mean, look at the outpouring of reaction also to
The media and from libertarians. But they, of course, and Justin Amash did
split on this issue. There's not an overwhelming majority in one way or the other. You get 50-some percent support the surveillance, depending on how you frame the question. 40-some percent in other polls. I don't think it's clear cut at all.
David, how do you see the division of opinion on that issue and the whole disclosure of the reach of the security state?
Well, I think Molly's right. There is a clear split. We haven't yet had time to process all of this information, but the Justin Amash amendment split both parties fairly closely in the House of Representatives. And you can assume that members of Congress want to vote in the interest of security. They want to vote with their leadership, with the president, and yet it was pretty close to a 50-50 split. There was a Pew poll that came out last week that showed a national movement of about 15 points away from we need to do more to we're doing too much on spying and surveillance. And interestingly, the biggest shift over the past 3 years was among Tea Party Republicans. Now, that may partly reflect their general anti-government attitude. It may reflect Rand Paul's leadership of that constituency. I would just point out it's not a clearly partisan thing, because the poll we're comparing it to was like late 2010. So they'd had plenty of time to think about Obama being president at that time, and they were still very supportive of do more to crack down on terrorism. 2.5, 3 years later, they've moved 35 points away from that. So I think that is an indication that there's movement. You're right. Libertarians would like to see a much more vociferous and unanimous national opposition. But there are real threats from terrorism. And I understand why Chris Christie can rally people in New York and New Jersey and people who care that much about terrorism and say, we have to do everything. But I think the more people realize it's our emails, it's everywhere we go on the internet, it's everywhere our automobiles go, it's every phone call we make for every American. Is that really necessary and appropriate?
Well, we'll see how that debate plays out, and we're going to go to listener calls in a moment. But I would just suggest to both of you that I think Hillary Clinton would be very comfortable running for president in 2016 as the candidate with the more aggressive, forward-leaning approach to national security against the Republican Party that was moving in the other direction. But let's take Lou, who's calling from Hamden, Connecticut. Lou, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call. So my comment is, I actually, during the last presidential election, I registered for the first time as a Republican so that I could vote for Ron Paul in the primary. And it wasn't really until I started paying a little bit more attention to the issues that I started to think to myself that, in a big way, the libertarian movement seems to me to be a big bait and switch from the Republican Party. Specifically, you know, obviously, I'm all for personal freedoms. I believe in civil liberties. But you can tell when you start to ask libertarians difficult questions about health care, about welfare, and about the environment, that you don't really get straight answers, particularly when it comes to the environment. I was raised to believe that your rights end where mine begin. And if we're going to talk about state rights when it comes to something like the EPA, for example, which is responsible for making sure that states do the right thing when it comes to their wastewater, polluting waterways, these kinds of things, okay, states' rights don't apply here because the actions that one state takes or the lack of action that one state takes when it comes to protecting clean water, protecting the environment, is going to affect states that you find downstream from there.
Lou, thanks for your call. I want to go to David Bowes. David, bait and switch?
Well, I hope it's not a bait and switch. I hope we're talking about individual freedom in all of these areas. Libertarians are very skeptical of command and control solutions from Washington for any issue. We tend to think that competition works better than centralization, and that includes even in protecting the environment. If you go to the Cato Institute's website, you can find books and articles on environmental issues. I think the big problem is that 100 years ago, we got away from protecting property rights and we wanted the government to encourage industrialization. Now, 100 years later, we're saying, gee, look at all this abuse of people's right to clean air and water by industry. Well, the government made that decision not to protect property rights. But that's a complicated issue you should do a whole show on. As far as welfare, Social Security, and things, yes, in general, libertarians are opposed to taking money from some people who have earned it and giving it to other people in government transfer programs. And we've noticed in Greece and Detroit and California and a lot of other places that countries and cities and states are getting overextended. We can't afford all these programs.
All right.
Eventually, we're going to fix them or we're going to go bankrupt.
Let's go to Gordon, who's calling from Felton, Delaware. Gordon, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. My comment is regarding a state convention that I was a part of. I was a GOP state convention delegate, and but was essentially Ron Paul. I was part of the Ron Paul contingent. And something that I'll always remember, it was the very first time that I was a GOP state delegate, was the complete disdain that, and animosity that the establishment showed toward anyone who was supporting Ron Paul. It wasn't civil. It was a total intolerance to, you know, anyone who was a supporter of Ron Paul. So when I experienced that, that sent me completely over to, you know, a libertarian party, third party mentality, and I actually ran for state representative as a libertarian party candidate and as an outsider going against a very well established Republican candidate. I still was able to garner 10% of the vote, but and the comment and also a question is, what can we do to better grow libertarianism on a state level?
Molly, thank you, Gordon, for that call. Molly, I want to ask you a question related to what Gordon just said. How does the libertarian movement build its clout in politics? And that 10% figure that he cited that he received in that election is significant because the Pew Research Center did a political typology study and concluded last year that only 10% of the electorate is libertarian. How do they make a majority out of that?
Well, I think this is where Rand Paul has a very delicate balancing act between his father's movement, that sort of 10% of the electorate that is very pure libertarian would prefer to vote third party before they vote for a Republican, and the sort of mainstream that Rand Paul is trying to woo and would have to win over in order to get through a primary, much less a general election. And so, you know, in a lot of these states, we have seen libertarians really make an effort to overthrow Republican leadership. They now control the Republican Republican apparatus in states like Iowa and Nevada, I believe in Maine. And so and this has caused a lot of consternation. There's still open conflict in a lot of these state parties. We saw at the Republican National Convention in 2012, many of the delegates loyal to Ron Paul actually walked off the floor of the convention in protest, and Ron Paul refused to speak at the Republican convention. Rand Paul didn't make that choice. He took a speaking spot at the Republican convention, and he gave a speech that was very strongly, you know, rah-rah Republican and in support of Mitt Romney. Some of Ron Paul's followers saw that move by Rand Paul as a betrayal. So Rand Paul is sort of testing how far he can go from that sort of pure libertarian loyalty and still retain those followers of his father who have no loyalty to the Republican Party as an institution and whose loyalty is entirely ideological, if not personal, to Ron Paul himself.
David, how far can Rand Paul go? You know, I spoke to Ron Paul at the convention last year. He said, I'm not going to speak at the convention because they said the price of my speaking was that I fully endorse Mitt Romney and I don't. Rand Paul did. He was willing to pay that price. What does he sacrifice, if anything, within the movement when he tries to strike that balance?
Well, I think that's a pretty clear difference between the two of them. Rand Paul shares a lot of his father's basic political principles, but he has rounder edges. He's a senator, not a House member. And he wants to move up in the Republican Party in a way that never interested Ron Paul. So I think it's pretty clear that Rand Paul is right now a front runner for the presidential nomination. He is trying to pursue a delicate balance of pushing in some new areas like changing foreign policy, changing our surveillance policies, while also holding on to the conservative and evangelical base. That's a challenge for any candidate. But I do think there are a whole lot of issues. Gallup pegs the libertarian vote at around 20-22%. But if you look at specific issues, a majority of Americans now support gay marriage. A majority now want to change the marijuana laws. A majority now think it was not a good idea to get involved in the Iraq war. A majority think taxes are too high. So the people who hold all of those positions may be only 15 or 20%, but the fact that there's a majority for each one is pretty promising for libertarian progress with a small L, moving in the right direction, getting more people interested in issues of individual freedom, and then it's up to any particular political leader to figure out how you get people who don't agree with you on everything to join your campaign.
I want to squeeze in one more call before the break. We've got Nancy from Somerset, Kentucky. Nancy, go ahead.
I have two questions for Rand Paul and the libertarians. One is, when Rand Paul first ran here in Kentucky for Senate, one of his top aides had to quit because of a racist, horribly racist cartoon on his webpage. And just recently, another top aide to Rand Paul had to quit because of an extensive racist background. And the second point is, when Exxon announced its record-breaking profits last year, I believe it was last year, Rand Paul said, yay, let the oil companies make as much money as they can.
So Nancy, thanks for your call. David, quick comment?
Well, I'll let Rand Paul handle the questions about his own staff. I will say I don't see any neo-Confederates in the libertarian movement except one or two around Ron Paul and this one example around Rand Paul. On the profits issue, I'm going to agree with Rand Paul on that one. In economics, a profit is an indication that you have taken resources that were not being used as well as they could have, and you have moved them to a place where they are better used. So I'm all in favor of companies making profits. It's easier to think about with drugs. Don't you want drug companies to make profits by finding drugs that people need and bringing them to market?
David Bose, thanks so much for joining us. Executive Vice President of the Cato Institute, Molly Ball, staff writer from The Atlantic, who covers national politics. Thanks also for being with us. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about libertarian ideals and what that means for the GOP. Joining me now from Bowling Green, Kentucky, is Senator Rand Paul, the junior senator elected in 2010, son of former Texas congressman and three-time presidential candidate Ron Paul, a leading libertarian thinker in his own right, former ophthalmologist, now lawmaker. Senator Rand Paul, welcome to On Point.
Hey, John. Glad to be with you.
Let me start because there is so much speculation about how the Republican Party is changing now and how it's going to change over the next 4 years. What is the goal that you've set for yourself in your political career for the party and for yourself?
You know, I think for the party, if we want to grow and be a dominant national party or even a competitive national party, we need to look like the rest of America. So I tell people we need black people, brown people, white people, people with tattoos, without ties. We need to look and represent a broad spectrum of people, from working class to business class. And I think we don't do a good enough job on that. And my goal over the next year or two is to try to broaden our appeal.
Beyond the next year or two, are you planning to run for president? You were in Iowa recently.
Well, you won't tell anybody, right?
I won't.
Okay. No, you know, I'm thinking about it, and we're talking with family, and we'll look at it over the next year or so and see, you know, how successful we are basically kind of trying to grow the party over the next year or so before making a decision.
If you were to explain to a voter out there who has followed your father's career, the time he ran for president as a libertarian, the two times he ran as a Republican, how would you distinguish your father's philosophy and approach to electoral politics from yours?
You know, I don't think it's particularly helpful. You know, when I go home at Thanksgiving, I still like to get a good seat at the adult table. So I try not to spend a lot of time either beating up or distinguishing myself. You know, I have a great deal of respect for my father. I think he's one of the few genuinely honest people that ever went to Congress. We don't agree on everything, but, you know, not very few people agree with everything with their spouse or their parents. But we have some things in common. We believe in limited constitutional government, a very strict interpretation of that. We believe in privacy, a less aggressive foreign policy. But there will be distinguishing characteristics. I just don't think it's useful to go through a list of that.
Now, when you think about how you are different, how you would distinguish yourself from other Republicans, the Republican establishment, if you will, or Republicans in the Senate, how do you think that effort to forge a new path is going? I noticed that you had an amendment to cut aid to Egypt the other day, which was defeated overwhelmingly. What did that tell you about how much progress you're making?
Dave, I've got a long ways to go. It tells me really, though, the Senate's out of touch. Because if you take that same question and we poll your audience and we ask them, do you think we should continue to send money to Egypt when they burn our flag, or do you think we should try to take care of some of the roads and projects we've got in our country, I think you'd get a reverse result. From your audience, I think you'd get 80% of your audience saying, you know what, I think we do have some problems to take care of at home, and a lot of that money gets stolen by dictators and despots and doesn't really go to the people there. And I told them during the debate, that money is as likely to buy a lavish chateau in Paris for a dictator as it is to buy bread for anyone in Cairo.
And, you know, John McCain, who was your party's nominee in 2008, having run against your father, he has been very critical both of your approach to foreign policy and to the Senate in general. He described you and Senator Cruz as wacko birds at one point. Now, if a maverick like John McCain, who has never been too beholden to the Republican establishment, has that view, what sort of impression are you making on the body right now?
Well, you know, I get along quite well with most of the people up there, even Senator McCain and I. I think we have I think we get along just fine. I have a great deal of respect for him as a POW and as a war hero. We don't always agree on foreign policy, but I think the new people in the GOP, and the new GOP that's going to be bigger and stronger and more national, is going to have a variety of opinions in it. And some of those are going to be more similar to mine, that believe that we don't have enough money to be everywhere all the time around the world. We should defend our country. It's our primary responsibility. But that doesn't mean a blank check. It means we should audit the Pentagon. It means we don't have to be involved in every civil war. And it's interesting, as you poll these questions too, and you ask people, should we be sending arms to Islamic rebels in Syria? I think you'll find the vast majority of Republican Party voters at the grassroots are opposed to that, and I know most Democrats are opposed to it as well. And yet the leaders of both parties are eager to send more money to Egypt and have more arms and more involvement in war.
You've also been at odds with some of the intellectual forces outside of Congress, the Wall Street Journal editorial page, when you were criticizing the security state and in the wake of some of the NSA disclosures, criticizing the use of drones. Wall Street Journal editorial board said that Senator Paul is he may be following up, firing up impressionable young kids in college dorms, but it's not a responsible approach to security policy. What's your reaction?
Well, you know, I disagree strongly. Their whole point was, oh, well, if someone's an enemy combatant, they don't have to get a trial and they can be sent to Guantanamo Bay, even an American citizen. But their whole point begs the question, who gets to decide who's an enemy combatant and who's not? Who gets to decide who gets charges and who's not? I think ideas of allowing an American citizen to be indefinitely detained and sent to Guantanamo Bay is so against what we stand for that it's going to bring new people into the party if we have a Republican who stands up and says, you know what, it was awful what happened to the Japanese Americans in World War II, and I'm never going to let it happen. It was awful what happened to black Americans in time after time throughout the Jim Crow years where they were apprehended, arrested, sometimes killed without trial or due process. Due process and constitutional rights are incredibly important to everybody, but particularly if you're a minority. And I think that message is a strong one, and I think it'll grow the party. And I think some of the old guard in the GOP just is out of step on this.
Now, you invoked the rights of black Americans, and you spoke at Howard University. You've talked about commitment to outreach. What should people draw? What conclusion should people draw from the presence of that former shock jock Jack Hunter on your staff, who co-authored a book with you, who was identified as the Southern Avenger?
He's no longer on my staff, and
but you had a pretty strong association with him.
Yeah, but the thing is if you'll read through a lot of his things, I think some of the things he wrote or many of the things he wrote were stupid and I don't agree with. They weren't things that I was aware of or reasons why I hired him. I do think, though, that he was unfairly treated by the media and he was put up as a target practice for people to say he was a racist, and none of that's true. And if you look at his writings, I think there are a lot of problems and a lot of disagreements, and none of it do I support, but none of it was racist, and there was no evidence. He got along fine with everybody in the office, treated everyone fairly, regardless of race or religion, and we have a very varied office staff and background, so I think that it was just unfair. But it's also unfair to paint a broad brush and say that's who I am when I should be judged by the things I'm doing. And I think there is no greater defender, truly, of minority rights, if you include minorities to be color of your skin or the color of your ideology, than myself, because I will stand up there with the most progressive members of the caucus in the Senate and say, you know what, civil liberties are important, and they're important particularly because of some of the egregious things that happened in America's history.
Well, let me read you something that The Economist, political magazine, the British magazine, wrote a few weeks ago and get you to react to it. Said, the only notable libertarian-leaning politicians to generate real excitement among conservative voters have risen to prominence through alliances with racist and nativist movements.
Don't you have anything better? Don't you have something better to read than a bunch of crap from people who don't like me? I mean, that won't make for much of an interview if I have to sit through, you know, reading after recitation of people calling me a racist.
No, I understand.
I don't accept all of that, and I don't really need to respond. Spend the time going and talking about that. If you want to talk about issues and what I stand for, I'm happy to, but I'm not going to really go through an interview reciting and responding to every yahoo in the world who wants to throw up a canard.
But why shouldn't, you know, if somebody sees the record of Jack Hunter and...
Well, why don't we talk about Rand Paul? I'm the one doing the interview, and you can go ahead and beat up on an ex-employee of mine, but why don't we talk about Rand Paul and what I'm trying to do to grow the party, and then we might have an intelligent discussion.
Well, I am, but he is someone who wrote a book with you.
Well, you're not. You think you want to dwell on something, that you want to bring up critical articles from people who don't like me and don't support any libertarian ideals. Why don't we talk about what libertarian republicanism means and what it would do for the party? Let's talk about some issues. Let's talk about indefinite detention. Let's talk about aid to Egypt. Let's talk about repatriation of foreign capital so we could redouble our infrastructure, which the president asked for last week. Those might be some pertinent topics other than doing ad hominem on me.
Let's talk about transportation. Republicans in the House of Representatives, because of some people, some small government Republicans who declined to vote for spending, had to pull down a transportation bill. And afterwards, you had the chairman of the Appropriations Committee in the House say essentially that Republicans have walked away from the Ryan budget and simply were not able to move forward and govern. We had a listener on Twitter who just sent a message and wanted me to raise it with you. What is wrong with compromise for the sake of progress? What's your response to that and to the problems of governance that Republicans are showing right now?
Right. Well, there ought to be compromise, and I think there are ways to find more money for infrastructure. So, for example, right now the biggest problem with infrastructure is the gas tax money that comes in is less than what we spend. We bring in about $30 billion, we spend $40 billion. That's irresponsible, and I will oppose that, and I'm not ashamed to say I'm not going to spend money we don't have, and I'm not going to borrow money from China to build roads and bridges. However, there's about $2 trillion overseas in American profits that would come home if we'd let it come home at about a 5% tax rate. Currently, it's 35%. I offered an amendment to the bill, which the Democrats denied, which would allow all foreign capital to come home at 5%. It would have doubled the infrastructure spending. The president goes around the country saying he wants a grand bargain. I let him know. I talked to the vice president last week, and I said, look, it's already out there. I have an amendment that would immediately double infrastructure spending in the country if you just go along with changing this tax rate to let foreign capital come home, and no response. So if they're serious about it, we've got the amendment and I've got the legislation that would double spending on infrastructure in our country.
Let's take a listener call. Tom is calling from Savannah, Georgia. Tom, go ahead.
Hi, John. I wanted to ask Senator Paul what he plans to do to get through to people who just won't listen. Judging from a lot of the comments I'm seeing about this conversation right now, people aren't listening to a word he's saying. They're just making really snarky remarks and neglecting to actually take into consideration his arguments.
Senator,
I think that's a good point, and I think if people would actually take the time to listen and discuss issues, you'd find that actually there is some intelligent debate going on instead of just making it about, you know, someone wanting to call someone else a name or accuse someone else of being something that they're not. So, for example, in the Senate, there are many people on the left side of the aisle who I do work with and have worked with. I've worked with Senator Leahy on trying to get rid of mandatory minimums, which I think are racially unjust and applied unfairly to minorities. I've also working with Senator Wyden on issues such as trying to bring the troops home sooner from Afghanistan, also working not to get us involved in Syria with other people from the other side of the aisle. So, see, I think you missed the point if somebody wants to drum up issues about a former employee and make an interview about something other than national issues.
Senator, I raised the issue with David Bowes from Cato earlier that there was a Pew study of the electorate last year, which concluded that only 10% of the electorate was libertarian. How do you take a core that's that small and turn it into a majority?
Well, no candidate or person or voter is purely any one segment. You know, you may be libertarian on some issues, you may be conservative on other issues. Politics is about fusing together the best elements of different ideologies. So I think what you find is that someone who's a libertarian conservative, I think the ideas that I represent, talking about no longer sending money overseas to countries that hate us, talking about a less aggressive foreign policy, a balanced budget, and I think if you look at those issues, you'll find that that actually represents a large segment of the Republican Party. But I think also it's attractive to independents as well, because there are many issues, such as a less aggressive foreign policy, that some independents shy away from the Republican Party because of that.
What about the fact that the two biggest domestic spending programs, Medicare and Social Security, which expand the reach of government, the role of government in our economy, leave aside Obamacare, which is another one, that those Medicare and Social Security are highly popular, and the libertarian movement at its core doesn't believe in those programs?
Well, see, I think you paint with a broad brush and you try to make libertarianism to be something you want to beat up on. The thing is that no one that I know of who is a libertarian conservative is advocating abolishing Social Security or Medicare. We are advocating that they be paid for. I have a bill that makes Social Security sound for 75 years. I also have a bill that makes Medicare sound for 75 years. So we really don't work at eliminating these things. We work at making them where they are cost efficient and work well and will be there for future generations. Medicare is $35 to $40 trillion short in the hole. For every retiree, we pay $3 for every dollar they paid in.
But, Senator, is it not correct that...
It's an untenable entitlement, and the way you have to fix it is you have to go through reforms, but the president's been unwilling to step forward and be a leader on these issues.
Well, fair enough. They as currently constituted, they do require reforms, but is it not the case that libertarians oppose the creation of programs like that to collect tax money from one group and transfer it to others in the first place?
History to your own liking so you can debate against something that's not there. There's nobody in the Senate, and I think the most libertarian members would probably be libertarian conservatives, would probably be Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, and I, and not one of us has been proposing eliminating any of these programs. We've been proposing reforming these programs by bringing in market forces, making them paid for, and talking about how future generations, because we're living longer, we'll probably have to wait a little longer to receive these benefits.
Before I let you go, Senator...
To build up a straw man and argue against a straw man, you're just making stuff up, so feel free, but that's not really what we're talking about.
Before I let you go, how do you think the exchange that you had over the last couple of weeks with Governor Christie came out?
You know, I think it's important that if we want to have a strong national defense, we have to be fiscally conservative and cut in other places. So you can't ask for a blank check, even for disaster aid. So I think that point is loud and clear for conservatives that if you believe in a strong national defense, you're going to have a conservative like myself who's willing to cut other places in order to preserve the defense.
Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, thanks so much for joining us. You can continue the conversation, get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, embassies on lockdown across the globe. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.